And the God of our fathers praise.
Our scripture reading this morning is found in Matthew chapter 19, beginning with verse 3 and reading through verse 6. And the Pharisees came to him and tested him by asking, "Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause?" He answered, "Have you not read that he who made them from the beginning made them male and female and said, 'For this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one.' So they're no longer two, but one. What therefore God has joined together, let no man put asunder."
Thank you, Will Ed, for the reading of the text. We're in a series on the home, and I'd like to dispel any false notions as we began looking at the home by saying that don't make the mistake of thinking that a successful marriage just happens. It doesn't happen without struggle and strain. And don't make the mistake of thinking that this oneness that we're talking about comes about just as a matter of course, automatically, because you happen to stand and say, "I do." In fact, don't even think that on the honeymoon everything is peaches and cream or roses without any thorns, because that's just not true. I remember on our honeymoon, and it wasn't true on that one. Let me tell you a thing or two, and then I can eat with you today in some other house other than my own. I took my wife as a new bride, took her into Alabama, to Talladega, finest place in the state, and took her to what I thought was the finest place for a honeymoon to be enjoyed. It was in a cabin up in a wildlife park. I didn't realize at the time that there were army blankets and no hot water. But she found out that there was no hot water and that we only had army blankets to sleep under. But that really wasn't what got us off to the good start. It was when we were down at the foot of the mountain getting ready to go up to the cabin. We stopped there and bought a week's supply of groceries, 4 pounds of bologna and 2 loaves of bread and some drinks. I know it sounds odd, but I wanted to have the best for her. She didn't say anything. We went on up, found this lovely cabin, and after about 3 days of living on bologna, I was out in the back scrounging around trying to find something or do something. I'm not sure what I was there for, but I saw this snake. And I thought, well, I'll just take this critter back and impress my wife. And I reached down to get it, and the rascal just chewed on my thumb. About that time, I heard this voice come off of the porch out of the cabin, and she said, as she had this bologna in her hand, she said, "If you think I'm going to eat this the rest of my life, you're crazy." I felt like Adam with a serpent chewing on one hand and my wife on the other. And that's just for an opener, you know. But it isn't all peaches and cream, even on your honeymoon. And you need to be aware of that. Because a lot of people go into marriage, I'm convinced, with such an idealistic, unreal attitude toward marriage and the home that they think it'll turn out like it does in a story, and the story that all the problems have been removed from. But that's not the way it is. There'll be trials, there'll be struggles, there'll be heartaches, there'll be headaches. There'll be times when you'll just wish that you didn't have any part of it. There'll be times when you seem to be giving everything and not being given anything. And I think you ought to realize that love's ledger is seldom ever perfectly balanced, where your outgo matches your income or where your income matches your outgo. In every relationship, at some time or other during that relationship, someone in the relationship will be giving more than they are receiving, and someone will be receiving more than they're giving. There are going to be times when you'll feel like the woman that I saw in the cartoon. You've heard the statement that it's better to have loved and lost than not to have loved at all. I saw this cartoon once of the mother standing there in front of the ironing board with a huge basket of ironing, and she was ironing, and two children were pulling on her skirt, crying, and one was down in the floor dumping something over his head, and another was in her arms chewing on her face, and she was ironing, and big old tears were coming down her cheeks, and she said, "Sometimes I wish I'd loved and lost." You're going to feel like that at times, too. There are going to be times when the grass will look greener on the other side. You may not think that now, but there will be times when the grass will look greener on the other side. And you may just get tired of the whole mess and wish that you could just say, I'm finished, I'm through with it. There was an old couple, been married, as the story goes, for some 50 or 60 years. And after that long together, they were sitting one night in front of the fire. And you may have heard the story. It's lovely, I think. It's pretty true to life. And she was there darning his socks. And he was sitting in front of the fire watching her. And as he watched her serve him in this very simple way, the feelings and the emotions and his appreciation welled up inside him. And he just spoke out. She was hard of hearing, and he spoke out and said, "I'm proud of you." She said, "Yeah, and I'm tired of you too." That's what you call unrequited love. But see, there the imbalance. But now let me show you something. At the time that she made that statement, and at the time that he expressed his love, they had been living together for some 50 or 60 years. By that time, they'd become so much a part of each other that you couldn't unravel them. By that time, after 50 years of marriage, she had cooked over 55,000 meals for that family. By that time, she had made, for an average family, she had made up over 91,000 beds. You think about it. And by that time, he had worked on his job over 100,000 hours. That's a lot of work going into a relationship, isn't it? They had become so much a part of each other that he had begun to look like her and she had begun to look like him. They'd begun to think alike. And many times after so many, many years together, when one of those dear souls dies, the other follows along in just a matter of months, because you just can't unravel lives that are so closely entwined. But how do you go about bringing such oneness to a marriage? How do you go about developing into such a beautiful oneness and unity? I believe there are three very simple principles that will help us as we continue to look into the subject of marriage in the home. One of these is that marriage must be recognized as being from God. As long as you think that it's just from man, your marriage is not going to have the permanency that it must have. Marriage must be recognized as verse 4 of this passage says, that do you not know that he who made them from the beginning made them male and female? That this was God's original design for man and woman. That this was God's original arrangement for society. And consequently, marriage is not left up to the whim of human beings. That which human beings create, human beings can destroy. But that which God creates, man simply cannot destroy. He must not. But we find ourselves faced, I think, with this very basic principle. that marriage must be viewed as originating with God, not man. This is what I refer to as the prior claim. Your marriage must possess this prior claim, that you're going to do what's right regardless of what you want to do, that you're going to maintain this marriage regardless of what you would like to do. And this prior claim is an absolute reality in the life of every successful marriage that exists today among Christian people. There exists this prior claim. Yesterday I was counseling with a couple, and Terry came in. I wanted them to meet him and him to meet them, and I was counseling them about their coming marriage. And Terry just simply said, "All right, let me just tell you real simply, if you've got Jesus Christ at the center of your marriage, you'll have a wonderful relationship. But if you don't, your marriage won't last. It's not going to last in the day that we're living now." He said, "Why, there was a time when my wife would have left me and I would have left my wife had we not been Christians." Well, I could have said the same thing. I could have said the same thing exactly. In fact, every one of you here today, if you're married and you're happily married and your marriage is a success, you know what I am saying. If I were to ask you to raise your hand, if there was a time in your life when you would have just called it off had there not been this prior claim on your life, you'd almost all would raise your hand. There was a woman who had been married for about 40 years and had been a very stormy, tempestuous marriage. And a friend of hers asked her one day, said, "Have you ever considered divorce?" And she said, "No, not divorce. Murder, yes, but not divorce." And that says something. It says she needs some more teaching along the line of murdering, but it also says that she's got something going for her about her marriage, that she just never considered divorce as an option. Now, the world doesn't look at it like that. The world that we live in today just does not look at marriage as having originated from God. There's a statement made by a very noted actress, Shirley MacLaine. She came out in print with this very bold statement: "I don't think it's desirable to conform to having one mate and for these two people to raise children. But everyone thinks that's the ideal. They go around frustrated most of their lives because they can't find just one mate. But who said that's the natural basic personality of man? To whom does monogamy make sense? To a muskrat, maybe. This is not the natural behavior pattern of a human individual. People who behave that way are operating out of a repressive culture, out of Christian doctrine, and out of 'thou shalt not commit adultery' in one of the Ten Commandments." And you'd be surprised what sizable portion of American society subscribes to that philosophy regarding marriage and the home. And because of it, our whole nation is being affected. Your marriage will be no more permanent than your respect for the originator of it, for your respect for the designer of it, for your respect for the purpose of it. Your marriage, based on today's society, with the lack of external restraints, with the lack of legal restraints, your marriage will not survive. You're not that good of a person for your marriage to survive very long under such circumstances as we have today if you do not possess this prior claim. In America, there are at least 14 states who possess or who have on their statute books what they refer to as no-fault divorce legislation. California has what they call a do-it-yourself quickie kind of divorce legislation and procedure. And I want to ask the question, if marriage is simply something that man concocted, then why not? Let's do it like that. But if marriage is from God, then we dare not do it like that. Marriage, in order for it to succeed, in order for it to be a lasting and enduring institution, must be recognized as being from God. And the moment we ever throw aside that basic conception of marriage, then our marriages are in dire danger. But there's a second thing, and that is that marriage must be fed and nourished on love instead of lust. This is found in verse 5 when it says that for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. There are a lot of reasons why I say that, but let me just say by way of introduction, whenever the butterflies in your marriage relationship start flying in formation, And I mean by that, they quit going completely crazy every time you see her and every time you see him. Whenever they finally come to their senses, and they're still there, alive and healthy, but they're at least flying in formation, and you've got them pretty well regulated, what are you going to do then? A lot of people look at that time and think, well, you know, I'm not in love anymore. When you wake up, and I remember Jimmy Allen saying this one night at a meeting, and it cracked me up, and I'm saying it not necessarily to be funny, but I want you to understand that there's a problem in store for you. Whenever you wake up some morning and look at the person in the bed beside you and realize that there's a person in that body, what are you going to do then when you find that you don't like some of the things about that person that's in that body? Have you fallen out of love? Well, if your marriage is based upon lust rather than on love, you'll find yourself saying, well, we just don't love each other anymore, and consequently, we're going to get a divorce. But this word, cleave to, has some interesting connotations. The definition of it means to be glued to be fastened inseparably to attach yourself to someone else. You cling to them, you cleave to them. Have you ever seen a tree that has a vine that over the years has wrapped itself so around the tree that it has actually embedded itself within the body of that tree? That's a good demonstration of what the word cleave to means. It means to cling inseparably to where one's life practically exists in the life of the other. It's expressed in our vows before the preacher, before the magistrate, for better or worse, for richer or poorer, in sickness and in health. That's the expression of this kind of love that must exist if your marriage is going to be acceptable and be successful. It's found also in Ephesians, the 5th chapter in verse 28, where the writer there says that the husband is to love his wife and is actually to give himself up for her, and that he is to nourish her and cherish her, and that no man ever hated his own flesh. It's this kind of a relationship that must exist between you and your wife if your marriage is going to be successful. Now, this kind of love is the kind of love that's eternal. It incorporates desire, physical desire, yes, but it does not end with, nor is it completed in the consummation of physical desire. You find this illustrated, this kind of love, illustrated with the man Jacob and his wife Rachel. Jacob worked for 7 years for Rachel. And it says that the days or the years passed by, and they seemed to Jacob to be just a very few days because of the love that he had for this girl. Now, that's the opposite of lust. Love considers 7 years as just a few days. Lust considers a few days waiting as 7 years hard labor. There's a great difference. And your relationship with the person that you're associated now needs to be weighed in the light of whether or not it's love or lust. There's another beautiful illustration of this kind of love found in Elizabeth Barrett Browning and her husband Robert Browning. You're familiar with that beautiful true life story. This woman, Elizabeth Barrett, had been assigned, it seemed by fate, to just simply be an invalid, to be a sickly individual that would die a premature death. And then all of a sudden, here came this man into her life. He came into her room and showed her genuine, wholesome love. And he so literally, with his love, picked her up and gave her the gift of life and completely renovated her whole existence because of the presence of this divine love. She reciprocated in a very beautiful way and wrote her 43rd sonnet. Listen to the depth of this expression. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach when feeling out of sight for the ends of being and ideal grace. I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely as men strive for right. I love thee purely as they turn from praise. I love thee with the passion put to use in my old griefs and with my childhood's faith. I love thee with a love I seemed to lose with my lost saints. I love thee with the breath, smiles, tears of all my life. And if God chooses, I shall but love thee better after death. Now that's love to a depth that not everyone perhaps can achieve naturally, and I think no one can achieve initially. But that kind of love comes as a reciprocal response to someone else who has actually laid down his life for you. So marriage must be viewed as from God if it's going to last. Marriage must be fed on love rather than on lust. And then finally, marriage must be regarded as permanent and not, as one couple insisted on saying, just as long as we both dig it. That's the way one couple, whose picture was in the paper, they made the headlines, couple decides to say as long as we dig it rather than until death does us part. But marriage must be viewed as being permanent, not temporary. From the fact that God has joined us together, Jesus drew the conclusion, let not man put it asunder. That isn't always easy to do, but even heathen people recognize that permanency in marriage is good. There was a man in 19 BC whose name was Quintus Vespilla. He was a Roman consul, and he and his wife had been married for 41 years at the time of her death. And on the gravestone of that man's, of the woman's tombstone, on that gravestone was written this by her husband: seldom do marriages last until death undivorced, but ours continued happily 41 years. Of course, we never met Quintus Vespilla, and he was not a Christian, but there's something about that man's attitude toward his wife that makes me respect him very highly. And I feel an affinity with him, even though he was not a Christian. I respect what he stood for when it came to the way he looked at his wife. You know what's involved in making oneness a reality? Time. Time is involved. Time is a dirty four-letter word for a lot of married people today. Stay is another dirty four-letter word. But if you're going to make your life and your life with someone else successful, you're going to have to realize that you're going to have to stay during the rough periods. You're going to have to stay during the time when perhaps you'd like to throw up your hands and leave, because marriage is a permanent arrangement. It's from God, and God therefore expects it to be permanent. But it does take time to produce this oneness. The two, Jesus says in verse 6, shall become. They shall become one. There's the poem by Edgar A. Guest that says, home ain't a place that gold can buy or get up in a minute. You've got to sing and dance for years. You've got to romp and play and learn to love the things you have by using them each day. Even the roses round the porch must blossom year by year before they come a part of you, suggesting someone dear who used to love them long ago and trained them to just run the way they do so's they'd get the early morning sun. You've got to love each brick and stone from cellar up to dome. It takes a heap of living in a house to make it home. And those are strange words to our culture. America, the average family moves from one house to another every 2 years. Unbelievable. I don't know how long it will be if we change our house that often. How long will it be before we change our spouse that often? And that's what's happening. Our whole culture is breaking down because our homes are breaking down. Do you know the greatest contribution that you and I can make to this nation? It's not in our taxes that we pay. It's not in sending sons to war. It's not in going out in protest marches against this, that, or the other. The greatest contribution that you can make to this nation is to solidify your home under the lordship of Jesus Christ. There's a poem that I want to close with, written by Grace Noel Crowell. She wrote the poem back when there was, I think, some chance. I may be very pessimistic, but I don't believe that we're there any longer. She says, so long as there are homes to which men turn at close of day, and then she continues in that vein of thought. But I would like to say, were there only homes to which men could turn at close of day, were there only homes where children are and women stay? Could there be faith and love and loyalty found across these sills? This stricken nation of ours could recover from its grievous ills. Could there be homes where fires burn and where there's bread? Could there be homes where lamps are lit and prayers are said? Though a people falter in darkness and nations grope, could God himself be put back into our homes, we would still have hope. Today, if you're married or if you're contemplating it, may I urge you this very simple formula. Let God be in your marriage as your prior claim. Let love be that which nourishes and feeds your marriage, not just lust. And then thirdly, let permanency provide the bridge over which the oneness must come if your marriage is to be the kind of marriage that God designed it to be. May God bless us in our search for a stable home. And may he make your home what God intended for it to be, for there's nothing more rewarding, but there's nothing a greater curse than a fouled up, unsuccessful one. Will you commit yourself to that today, right now, as we extend the invitation, obviously, toward this direction for the Christian in his home? Will you commit yourself today to putting Christ as the head of it, letting love be that which nourishes it, and letting time be that which takes it on to perfection? We're going to sing this song, and we'll extend the invitation of Jesus Christ along these lines. Perhaps you want to counsel with someone. You may not want to come forward publicly. You may want to call this afternoon and say, I want to talk. My wife and I need to talk with you. That's what we're after today. Would you do something along this line as we respond now to the invitation?